Welcome to Conversations on Healthcare with Mark Maselli and Margaret Flinter. Mark is the founder, president, and CEO of Community Health Center Incorporated, a provider of primary healthcare services for the uninsured and underserved in 13 cities and 218 service locations in Connecticut. Margaret is senior vice president and clinical director of CHC and is a family nurse practitioner by profession. Conversations on Healthcare is a weekly look at the people and ideas that are transforming the delivery of healthcare in America. And this week, Mark and Margaret will be speaking with Dr. Clement Beazold. In the Tech Report segment, Marianne O'Hare reports on a new tool for the early detection of autism. And we begin with this week's bright idea.
Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. When 22-year-old college student Ludwig Marashane was on an extended trip to Africa, he and his fellow students bemoaned the lack of available water to take a shower. The awareness of that very real problem, lack of water for basic hygiene in many parts of the world, got him thinking. What if there were a product that could take the place of a shower, that could perform the same task of cleansing that soap and water does? When he returned to the University of Cape Cod, he set to work. 6 months of research on biodegradable and antimicrobial products led to a unique invention simply called Dry Bath. And it's not just a rehash of hand sanitizer, which is made largely from alcohol and other chemical products. Marashane's odorless and biodegradable body bath gel is a proprietary combination of biocides, bioflavonoids, and moisturizers. The product has been shown to reduce bacteria by 99% and have a lasting antimicrobial effect. Already, there's keen interest from several sectors, including the airline industry, which sees the commercial value of providing the product for folks on long flights. And Marashane sees numerous potential applications, specifically having the potential to improve health and wellness through better hygiene in developing regions that lack basic access to bathing water. Dry Bath has earned Marashane the 2011 Global Student Entrepreneur of the Year Award. A simple biodegradable gel that could improve hygiene for areas of the world lacking basic access to clean bathing water, potentially improving the general health of those communities as a result. Now that's a bright idea.
We're speaking today with Dr. Clement Beazold, co-founder, chairman, and senior futurist at the Institute for Alternative Futures, which was formed in 1977 to encourage anticipatory democracy and to analyze global trends, particularly in the future of healthcare and other social issues. Dr. Beazold is the author of more than 10 books, as well as the author of numerous forecast and research papers, and is the consulting editor of the Journal of Future Studies. Dr. Beazold, welcome to Conversations on Healthcare.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Dr. Beazold, you founded the Institute for Alternative Futures along with the noted author of Future Shock, Alvin Toffler. That groundbreaking book, published in 1970, analyzed how society is undergoing an enormous structural change, and this accelerated rate of technological and social change is really quite overwhelming to the society. Technology is revolutionizing so many aspects of our lives, especially in the delivery and use of healthcare. Help us understand the key ideas of Future Shock and the changes in technology as it relates to healthcare.
Yeah, Alvin Toffler published it in 1970. He'd been writing it during the course of the 60s, so it was more than 40 years ago. And what he anticipated, what he saw, was the speed of change as we were moving from an industrial society to an information society. And that there was a stress of this degree and pace of change that is Future Shock. And he identified his prescription for it was anticipatory democracy. But in health, what he anticipated was and identified eustress, which was good stress, and health affecting negative stress. And that was part of the biggest aspect that he identified. Since he developed that in 1970, he's also done a number of other books, Third Wave and others. But the big issue for health was starting to be aware of sort of what is the level of stress. How does the change around us affect us? In more recent years, there are a whole host of issues about genomics, about genetic engineering, about brain-mind interactive tools, about artificial intelligence that are increasing the pace of change. And so that the threat of future shock remains out there.
So, Dr. Beazold, we're now living the future that was predicted back in 1970. And as a futurist, you've looked into the future from here and done some long-term projections on everything from the impact that we will realize of the diabetes crisis to the future of community community health centers, and also predicted what primary care is likely to look like in 2025 and beyond. And you, of course, use some pretty sophisticated predictive techniques to do that. For those of us who are engaged in organizing or delivering healthcare and in healthcare policy, tell us, what's your unique approach to forecasting these trends? How do you arrive at the conclusions that you do, and maybe share some of those predictions with us?
There are a number of approaches to developing forecasts and scenarios in the futures field. It's a small industry. Basically, there's agreement that you look at the experts, you understand what the current trends are, you clarify the systems, you identify key drivers of change, you forecast those, and you do that both with experts looking at the literature. In some cases, you can ask the public directly. But what we add then is you ask both what is likely to happen given current trends, but also what challenges are out there, what could go wrong, and then finally ask what visionary or surprisingly successful outcomes would look like. And so you then use the forecasts and scenarios to paint a path to what's expectable or most likely, what's challenging or difficult, and what's visionary or successful. And you put all those three together. That leads in healthcare to fairly different forecasts for healthcare itself.
Now, the Institute for Alternative Futures recently produced a report with support from the Kresge Foundation entitled Primary Care 2025, a Scenario Exploration. Now, that explores several different views of what primary care could look like in 2025 and beyond. And you describe those scenarios from a low zone of growing desperation to a zone of high aspiration. But tell us a little more about the partners who participated with you in crafting this document, and how did this come about?
The Kresge Foundation does a lot in primary care and in supporting healthcare, and they agreed to fund these scenarios. We worked with a variety of groups. We partnered with the National Association of Community Health Centers, NAC, and David Stevens was one of our major partners. But for the Primary Care 2025 report, we actually started interviewing experts, and 56 experts later, we had gotten very rich sets of input. We then went to 10 primary care provider groups, Kaiser Permanente, Group Health, the Surgeon General of the Air Force, Surgeon General of the Army, small clinics, integrative clinics, and put in front of them various forecasts and said, how will your primary care be in 20? What will it be in 2025? What will it look like given these forces? And use those focus groups to help us develop those scenarios as well.
Dr. Biesold, I know we're going to want to hear more about that community health center report in a minute, but first I'd like you to spend some time maybe sharing with us these scenarios that you've developed. And I understand there's sort of four likely scenarios that you envision for primary care. And maybe we could just look at the first two of them for a moment. And you title them Many Needs, Many Models, and the second, Lost Decade, Lost Health. First sounds more optimistic than the second. Maybe you could share a little bit about those scenarios with our listeners.
Yeah, the first Many Needs, Many Models is sort of the extrapolation of where we're going now. Ultimately, we get some additional movement into integrative systems. We still have a lot of fee-for-service. Primary care moves to the patient-centered medical home. But we also get a large influx by 2025 of digital health coaches. And what that is the capacity to have each individual, often through their provider, but sometimes spying on their own, in effect an expert physician, the way that Watson beat humans, IBM's computer Watson beat humans in Jeopardy. We're going to have Doc Watson and other things like that that take all knowledge, personalize it to you, and will personalize our vital signs and tells us sort of where we are. That will be integrated into healthcare, and it will have very rich primary care teams, including greater emphasis on nurse practitioners. Scenario two is lost decade, lost health. And that's, you know, the challenge is that we could be going in for a double-dip recession or worse, depending on a variety of things. This scenario assumes that we don't get our act together, we don't get healthcare reform, we muddle along, many healthcare providers actually go out of business, including many community health centers. We do get advances in this second scenario, including cures for Alzheimer's. The challenge is they tend to be very expensive, so the $60,000 a year cure for Alzheimer's is great for rich people, but most people don't get it. And that minute clinics become more important, emergency rooms stay important, particularly for those people who don't have access to community health centers.
We're speaking today with Dr. Clement Biesold, Chairman and Senior Futurist at the Institute for Alternative Futures, the leading organization that provides industry forecast for policymakers and stakeholders in healthcare and other social disciplines. Let's pull the thread a little more on those primary care models that you were just talking about. And there are two other scenarios that you predict which seem to incorporate reiterate some ideas central to the themes of the Affordable Care Act. And the third scenario is primary care that works for all, which focuses on the triple aim of healthcare reform. And the fourth scenario, I am my own medical home, which you call a surprisingly successful integrated care model. Can you tell us a little more about those two scenarios?
Yeah, scenario three, primary care that works for all, does adopt the triple aim that says we want to lower per capita cost while we increase the excellence of healthcare experience and we increase population health, a whole new set of assignments for healthcare providers. That leads to a movement of primary care from the patient-centered medical home to this community-centered health home. But it also focuses on the community, it analyzes community conditions, and healthcare providers become, along with other community partners, community health advocates for shaping the social determinants of health. In this scenario, the primary care team expands. We get community health workers going into people's homes, supported by the digital health coach and advanced practice management. We also do community mapping in ways that say, you know, where are the hotspots for ill health? How do we pursue those? Many of which involve the social determinants of health beyond clinical care. Scenario four is I am my own medical home. And what that says is we don't get quite the assurance that we did in scenario three that you'll never spend more than 10% of your income on your healthcare insurance. And so consumer-directed health plans where you pay lower premiums, but you pay out of pocket for the first several thousand dollars, become the norm for about 40% of the population. The good news in this context, and why we called it I Am My Own Medical Home, is that those 40% have very powerful tools for doing their own self-management, self-care. We will get in all the scenarios the ability to identify cancer, diabetes, heart disease very early. In many cases, then we'll be able to focus on prevention or on changing things around. They also have transparency so that if they want to go and buy something out of pocket, they know the success rate of the doctors and the primary care teams in their community. They know what they charge. They know from, there's now a group called Patients Like Me. In this scenario, it evolves to SNPs Like Me, the basically segments of your gene that define certain health conditions. Those are grouped together in a way so that you're getting advice from people who have conditions very much like you, who've gone shopping for doctors. So all of that transparency and knowledge will come together.
It's very interesting. We've just in the last month at our annual Weizmann Symposium had leaders both from the retail clinic movement and from Patients Like Me join us as really exemplars of disruptive innovations in healthcare that are driving things forward. So we really appreciate your comments there. So we've been talking mostly about primary care broadly defined, but let's talk for a few minutes about community health centers. Tell us why you've concluded that community health centers figure so significantly in the future of healthcare and the future of primary care.
We have a major health equity project at the Institute for Alternative Futures, and in looking for innovations about 8 years ago, identified the collaboratives within community health centers as one of the most significant quality improvement, disparity-reducing advances in U.S. healthcare. And that has led us to pay attention to this, to health centers and their unique role in providing both increasing quality, team-based care, while serving poor, marginalized populations. In their program expectations, say that the job of a community health center is to increase access not only to health care, but to services and resources for the people they serve. And the people who first founded community health centers, particularly Dr. Geiger, had had the experience of community-oriented primary care working as an intern in Africa, where there was not a separation between what the primary care providers did and how they worked to improve community conditions. So the way we put it is that working on the social determinants of health is in the DNA of community health centers.
And one of the issues that health centers have to address is in healthcare is the sort of lack of effective public policy directing the training of healthcare workforce for tomorrow. And you note in your Primary Care 2025 that there is an oncoming shortage of primary care physicians, and same time we're seeing an uptick of those who are seeking nurse practitioner and physician assistant diplomas, and you predict the growth of increase of community health workers and digital health coaches. Talk to us a little bit about how do you see the impact on public policy of in training the next generation of healthcare providers?
Yeah, that's a great question. And in effect, the forecast for the shortage of primary care physicians really varies from scenario to scenario. But the public policy questions of, you know, in effect, we do massive support to train physicians and in particular give them residencies and hospitals when they should be getting residencies in primary care in particular, those settings where they're actually going to practice.
We agree.
And hooray for community health centers again because of the programs they have that are using community health centers as residency sites. But that's for physicians. The issue for us and the scenarios tend to support the notion that primary care physicians will become, in effect, the caregiver for the complex primary care patient, and that increasingly people on the team, nurse practitioners, physician assistants, will become important as prime providers, given the tools that we will have. The community health worker now provides a significant service. And the community health worker is someone who comes from the community, shares the community's values, understands what's going on. In most cases, they're not a college graduate, but they do provide a number of important functions. In fact, Health Affairs had a recent article where a community health worker type approach was able to save significant money by doing home visits. When we put that together with the enhanced aids that the practice management software, electronic medical records, and digital coaching will have, the community health worker could be significant. Right now, federal policy is geared to generate more physicians in more specialties. That needs to be adjusted to focus on nurse practitioners, physician assistants, and this new category or this growing category of what's the role of the community health worker. The policy needs to shift.
In all of these projected new healthcare models, there certainly seems to be one recurring theme, and that's of the empowered patient. And I think we all agree we'll see healthcare with patients having multiple level of engagement and empowerment. You recently, on PBS, I think, had a hypothetical patient of the future that you talked about, Mary, an uninsured 50-year-old patient with diabetes who strongly engages in her own healthcare management and does it really pretty effectively. Describe Mary's situation for us and how technology is going to make it easier for her to be an empowered, effectively self-managed patient as we go through this big transitional period that's ahead of us.
So Mary's situation varies across the four scenarios. So in the first, she's got the digital health coach. She's got diabetes, but it's under control. Her primary team member in scenario one is a nurse practitioner, but she does have health insurance. The scenario two, she does not have health insurance, and she doesn't have a regular physician, so she uses the Minute Clinic in the emergency room. She has access to digital coaches, but she can't afford to buy one, so she gets the ones that are for free. There will be free digital health coaches, and they may not be as reliable. So in scenario two, she's more at risk. Her diabetes is a little more likely to go out of control, but she doesn't have significant resources. Scenario three, she's got the digital coach, but she's got the community health worker who comes to her home and helps support her in terms of activity and nutrition being among the most significant things that enables Mary to keep her weight under control and keep the diabetes and glucose levels appropriate. And then in scenario four, she is her own medical home, and she has a digital coach. She has access to care when she needs it, but she doesn't need it as much, and since she's paying out of pocket, she uses the digital health coach and the Patients Like Me, SNPs Like Me diabetic network to self-manage.
Dr. Beasel, you talk about one of the tools that's going to greatly reduce health disparities is biomonitoring, and you also talk about the future of healthcare where food will be as much a part of a treatment regime as medicines are, and that evidence-based nutrition information will increasingly become part of the future patient care protocol. And then, of course, you mentioned the sort of the top of the show about the genomics. So talk to us about these game changers and how they fit into the next larger context of healthcare of the future.
Okay, let me start first by saying genomics and our gene fingerprint will be really important. Equally important will be our zip code and the social determinants of health of where we live. And we'll come to understand the role that our community conditions fit. The genomics piece is we will increasingly understand the genome. It'll be low cost to map it. We'll be able to have it in our medical records. At the same time, we'll come to understand whether you have a gene, whether it expresses, is the function of other factors beyond your genome itself. And we'll understand that mix, and that will get integrated. The food question becomes really important, both because we all uptake our food very differently, but food is essentially the quantity of calories, the nature of calories, all of those become very important at the same time as our energy balance. The biomonitoring will take a number of forms. We'll have bed pads that we just sleep on and get a lot of what a sleep lab tells us about our sleep quality. We'll have wristwatches or earrings or eyeglasses that we basically understand heart rate variability. Each of us has a range of normal that's different than the population as a whole. We will come to map that with biomonitoring, but we'll also understand our food intake, what difference it makes for us. We'll understand our genomics and epigenetics. We'll understand our stress levels. Our systems will also say, do you have access to healthy food? Is your neighborhood safe? Do you have a job? Are you socially isolated in ways that affect your health? And how do you understand that? So individually and more collectively, we will focus on understanding those things and on acting on them.
Great. And Dr. Bisalt, we'd like to ask all of our guests this final question. When you look around the country and around the world, what do you see in terms of innovation that our listeners at Conversations should be keeping an eye on?
I would look at community health centers and this notion of leveraging the social determinants of health and what it means for healthcare providers to do that. I'd say the larger healthy community movement and understanding the community conditions will be significant. I think the food and nutrient question, both in terms of getting accessible, low-cost, healthy foods, will be relevant. The future of Doc Watson as one example of what will become the digital health coach, but there'll be other competitors as well, and watch that in terms of what's happening. Those would be among the innovations, I'd say.
We're speaking today with Dr. Clement Bisalt, Chairman and Senior Futurist at the Institute for Alternative Futures, whose recent report on the future of primary care, diabetes, and community health centers stands poised to have a significant impact on the look of American healthcare in the future. Dr. Bisalt, thank you so much for joining us today on Conversations.
Thank you.
I'm Ariane O'Hare with this tech report. The medical community may have a new tool for diagnosing autism that could be readily deployed for early detection of the brain disorder, which affects an estimated 1 in 84 children in this country. Researchers at Boston Children's Hospital have used the electroencephalogram, or EEG, to identify the connectivity of the brains of kids suspected of having autism. That is, how well the sections of their brains communicate with other sections. Dr. Frank Duffy, a neurologist and researcher, long suspected the part of the brain connected to language was the most likely culprit in kids with autism, and an EEG should be able to spot abnormalities in that and other regions. His study of over 1,000 children, some 440 suspected of having autism, and the rest in the so-called normal category, said the findings were consistent almost to a patient. The children suspected of having autism, some as young as 2, showed significant lack of connectivity in a specific part of the brain connected to language development.
This region is referred to as the arcuate fasciculus and is an area that is highly involved in normal language function. Autism is defined really by defects in language and communication, and very few autistics are skilled in language. What it shows is a decrease of connectivity in this area.
Dr. Duffy's study did not include those with Asperger's or so-called high-functioning kids who were placed somewhere on the autism spectrum disorder charts. He wanted first to identify a diagnostic EEG reading that could quickly identify the typical autistic child already overtly exhibiting symptoms. He says he's not certain that those with Asperger's or even Fragile X syndrome should be placed in the autism categorization.
Asperger's is a problem as well as having many redeeming features that can be taken to make a good life. But their problems are different from the problems of children with more typical autism.
Dr. Duffy's team does plan to use this new EEG diagnostic test to hunt for abnormalities or lack of connectivity in the Asperger's population. But in the meantime, his results show pretty conclusively that an early EEG test could identify even infants who are at risk of being diagnosed with autism.
We should be able to determine if, in fact, we can pick up early on from infancy EEG patterns that allow us to predict the ultimate development of autism.
You can find the study in the online open source journal BMC Medicine. I'm Ariane O'Hare with this tech report.
If you have questions for Mark Maselli and Margaret Flinter or would like to subscribe to the podcast, you can visit them on the web at chc1.com. The Health Forum is part of Connecting Our Communities from Connecticut Public Broadcasting in partnership with area nonprofits, and production support for Conversations on Healthcare has been provided in part by Community Health Center Incorporated. You're listening to WNPR, Connecticut's public radio station.